It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Welcome to... Hey, Great Shot. This is the Great Shot Podcast, a Cracked Rackets and Tennis Channel Podcast Network production. My name is Alex Gruskin. On today's show, we kick off our coverage of the 2022 Australian Open. Of course, over the next few days, we will try to preview that event from every angle possible. We'll talk about our men's and women's contenders for the title, talk about the dark horse picks we think might do some damage, talk about the Americans we'll be watching most closely. Then, of course, once they're released, we'll break down the draws for the men and women. We'll recap qualifying once it's completed as well. All of that content going to be found either here on the Great Shot Podcast feed or over on our Mini Break podcast feed. Of course, you can find links to all of our episodes wherever you listen to your shows or on our website, crackedrackets.com. Of course, on this episode, you're going to hear from a returning champion to our Cracked Rackets shows, Tennis Abstract's Jeff Sackman, joining me today to talk about the most interesting Americans to watch at this 2022 Australian Open. Of course, it's such a fascinating time right now in American tennis. The depth on the men's side at levels we haven't seen since the 1990s. And of course, Isner still hanging around. You get other veterans in the mix, the Jack Sox, Dennis Kudlas, Marcos Girones of the world, Stevie Johnsons starting to play some of their best tennis again. But of course, it's this next wave of American men's players from Mackie McDonald all the way through to Jensen Brooksby, Brandon Nakashima. Of course, you've got the Opelka, Tiafoe, Fritz Paul generation in the mix. Stefan Kozlov looking to capitalize on his late 2021 season success with a wild card into this Australian Open. So many fascinating men's storylines. Of course, women's side has always had depth, but with no Serena Williams in the draw, who will be the last American standing? Will it be a Pegula, a Stevens, a Madison Keys type veteran, Danielle Collins, or will it be that next gen wave of talent on the American women's side? Of course, Sonia Kenin returning to health, not defending, but 2020 Australian Open champion. She's back in the draw. You've got Coco Gauffs of the world, Ann Lees, Amanda Anisimova's. Point being, it's a fascinating time to be an American tennis fan. Plenty of things to watch here. And of course, no better person to help break it all down than Jeff Sackman. Of course, I also wanted to pick Jeff's brains about the latest and greatest things happening at Tennis Abstract. Simply put, the best resource for anyone who wants to follow the game of tennis closely and with some semblance of intellectual or some sort of intellectual backing to your opinions. You got to turn to Jeff for all of the numbers. So we talk about that at the beginning. I also wanted to get his take on Novak Djokovic. Of course, that is the storyline at this 2022 Australian Open, so probably going to ask all of the people who join us about it until we have a conclusive answer to his status. But then, of course, we get into the Americans, talk about the most interesting ones we'll be watching closely and have as much fun as we always do whenever Jeff joins the show. So without further ado, enough with the plugs. You can find all the content at crackedrackets.com, but let's get to it. Here is my conversation talking the most interesting Americans at the 2022 Australian Open with the one and only Jeff Sackman.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Joining us on the podcast once again today is a returning champion to our Cracked Rackets shows. Of course, you know he's got all of the numbers, even if podcasting with him disrupts your slumbers. And don't let his good looks and his charm distract from all the fantastic work he's doing at Tennis Abstract. It is retired podcaster Jeff Sackman joining us on the show today. Jeff, hey, great shot. Welcome back. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. I feel like you confused me with someone else for some of that intro, but I'll pretend like you didn't. That was very kind of you.
You're right. The charm, that's not you. That's someone else. But everything else, holds up.
I appreciate your dedication to the truth, Alex.
You know, I do what I can. I won't lie. Was I hurt when I found out that there was a Gil Gross podcast coming up in your future? Yes, I thought you'd never step out on this thick-eyebrowed, loving man. But, you know, again, from one thick-eyebrowed host to another, clearly you've got a type. I almost worked that into the intro. I was like, I'll save that for the next episode. But it is good to have you back. And, again, the work you did at Tennis Abstract this offseason, before we get into today's exercise, we hinted at it last time. You got deep in the 1910s, 1920s, my friends. I feel like right now you're probably part of the Habsburg Empire, or you're getting ready for World War One with where your mindset is at.
Yeah, I've been going through World War One. My goal, well, it's funny, going through the last year, I keep moving the goalposts on myself. When I started looking into women's tennis history, I was thinking like, okay, well, we don't have complete records on the whole open era, so let's fill in the gaps. Let's finish the open era. Then when I got through with the open era, I was thinking, well, who's the two most important players at this point? It's Billie Jean King, it's Margaret Court, and they both started playing in the early 60s. So am I just going to sit here and not know what Margaret Court did from 1961 to 1967, or Billie Jean King from 1961 to 1967? Of course we have to know. So I went back a little further, and then I got there and started getting interested in those players. And it's like, okay, I'll go back to after World War II. And then, you know, over the course of a year and serious repetitive stress injuries to my fingers, I just kept going back further and further. And now there are women's tennis results back to, I think, 1915 on Tennis Abstract. So I'm through World War One. The World Wars are easy. I mean, tragic at the time, but now they're easy for me because there's not any tennis in Europe when World Wars are happening. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot less work to do. It's just a bunch of American tournaments. But I'm now seeing the other side of that. And there's a huge amount of stuff at Tennis Abstract. And one of my projects for this year, I'm not giving away the big headline project for another few weeks until after the Australian Open, but I'm going to really dig into this data and come up with some stuff that I don't think anyone else has ever done before. So lots to look forward to this year.
There's nothing I enjoy more than rolling over every morning in bed and looking at my Twitter. And I suppose that is the least healthy thing you can do. It's part of the habit. And I see a Jeff Sackman, Bill Tilden related tweet, or just some sort of fantastic newspaper clipping. And just, it's a great way to start the day. And so it has been very refreshing to have in the, what's that called? The Twitter, the list of tweets.
Twitterverse.
No, I forget the dashboard or whatever it's called. Yeah, it's great to have on the the news feed. There it is, on the feed to start the day. And all I heard there was an excuse to have you back on in a couple of weeks to talk about that project. Is there any outlying stat, any one thing, if you're going to give me one big takeaway from the 1950 to 1960 results, what would it be?
1950 to 1960.
1915, excuse me.
1915. Okay. I'll give you one that I tweeted a hint to. This is there were a lot of really lopsided scores. I mean, even apart from people like Helen Wills, who would just blast through opponents, and I've seen news reports that are like, this match was 6-love, 6-love, and the opponent lasted 14 minutes. and that's not even uncommon. Like there's one report, I think when Helen Jacobs came back for a tournament in the early 40s, she played her first three rounds in one day, that itself wasn't that strange, but she played three rounds in one day and her total time on court was an hour.
That's amazing.
It's not even that unusual. That's the crazy thing, is that they played so fast and the best players were so good. But despite all that, there were a lot of deuces. This is something that, I mean, you only hear about it when it happened. No one's going to write a news report about, you know, Helen Wills beat this poor girl and only lost 5 points. But it was really common for two players to end up with a score of like 6-love, 6-1. And every game but one or two would go to deuce, even against Helen Wills. So I wonder whether there was more of a mental aspect to it then, or people were just afraid of beating someone like Helen Wills. I can't really explain it, but it's this weird mix of very tight games and very lopsided matches that I feel like the further back you go in history, the more of that you get.
Conspiracy Jeff. the Hellens had to cover the spread. And, you know, you got to make it entertaining, but it got to cover that spread in 1915. The bookies were all getting after it. I learned two things there. A, if I want my future daughter to have success as a professional player, name her Helen, that I'm locking that in.
Yeah.
B, you might be the best person for me to ask this question to, and it's one of my theories, and I'm going to stick with it till the end of time. If you put, I'm not going to say 2021 Alex Gruskin because I don't move quite like I did, but I'm going to say first semester, senior year, 2016, I guess, fall of 2016 Alex Gruskin with his modern racket and his modern strings and his witchcraft of a two-handed backhand into 1915. Am I a multi-time Grand Slam champion? Am I knocking these guys off?
Well, first off, I have to tell you, I know you've been interviewing too many college coaches lately because you have asked me this before.
yeah, but now you've done the research.
I have done more research. I have cloned you. I have gone back in time with Alex too, and run several hundred experiments. You know, I have thought about it more though, and I said last time that no, you don't stand a chance, and I think I stick with that.
No.
And I would say the same about myself. It's not a criticism of you. I don't know how good a player you'd have to be with a modern racket to go back and dominate. But I mean, for one thing, the wooden racket doesn't take that much away from your serve. It makes it harder, but the best player, somebody like Bill Tilden, was serving precisely and serving hard. I don't know whether we're talking like 80 miles an hour or 110 miles an hour, but they were serving big. So I don't think you're going to win a lot more. You're not going to break them a lot more than you would break like a good Division I player these days.
Fair. I was going to say, I think my biggest concern, and I know you've run the analytics on this, is the fact that I'll be playing in khakis. Like, that could be an issue for me. The polo shirt, I've never enjoyed playing in a collar. Never brings out my best tennis.
I like playing in a collar. I played it at Longwood in Boston, which has a ton of grass courts and a long storied history. And there's like a dress code there, so you have to play in a collar. I enjoyed it. I'd never done it before, but it made me feel both classy and skilled at the same time.
Oh, my senior year of high school, our head coach, whom I love to this day, was determined that we would wear collared shirts because we were going to be very good and he wanted to beat everyone while looking classy. He was very funny in his pitch. And so he convinced the team and I was crushed. I was like, come on, guys. I was like, this is such a mistake. But nevertheless, we wore the collared shirt. And thus, I suppose I would not be good enough to win the 1915 Wimbledon, although I'm still holding out hope. And yes, we will continue to explore that, I'm sure. We're going to continue to explore that whenever I have you until the answer is yes, because, you know, I'm nothing if not persistent. But with all of that said, surprisingly, that is not the reason we wanted to have you on the show today. Of course, it's crazy to think the Australian Open starting next week, whether we like it or not, whether Novak Djokovic will be there or not. And by the way, it's in the Tennis Channel Podcast Network edict. We have to spend some time in the first 20 minutes talking about Novak Djokovic, talking about whether he will or won't be in the draw. But what I wanted to do on today's show is talk with you about something different than what we normally focus on, and I'm sure there will be some ELO rating talk, and I'm sure eventually I'm going to ask you for some predictions, but I wanted to talk about the Americans and the most interesting Americans entering this 2022 Australian Open, because of course, if you look at the men's rankings, and we talked about this all offseason, the American men are as deep as they have ever been since the 1990s. And while the success at the top, you don't have a Sampras, you don't have an Agassi, a Curry, or even an early Michael Chang, you have a bunch of guys nipping at the bit. And a particularly young class of Americans, from Mackie McDonald all the way through to the Brandon Nakashima, Jensen Brooksbys of the world, who feel like they have some staying power on the men's side. Of course, on the women's side, with the return of Amanda Anisimova, title winner in week number one, and Lee's continued rise last season, Jessica Pegula, one of the standout stars of the year, and just, again, the depth in American women's tennis. I think it has been a staple of women's tennis over the past couple of decades. It's a fascinating time right now for the Americans. With all of that said, Jeff, I don't think, I mean, you haven't been particularly vocal about the Novak Djokovic stuff on Twitter. I think that's because I would imagine, knowing you like I do, your view on this pretty clear cut. Give me your take. Is he in the draw? Is he not? How does it affect the ELO?
Well, listen, you just said you know me so well that you have a pretty good idea of what my take is. What do you think my take is?
I imagine you are just done with Novak Djokovic. You're like, why is he in the draw? This is stupid. We're compromising public health for a tennis tournament. He had the chance to get vaccinated. He didn't. I'm sorry. You lose.
That's a reasonable enough position. I would just go cut straight to the this is stupid. setting aside all the other considerations, I feel like the more you dive into the details, the more you can get sucked in, and we could spend the whole hour talking about this, as I'm sure you have with other unsuspecting guests. But it seems like it's gotten so complicated out of nothing. Like, whether or not there should have been an exemption for Novak, whether or not Australia wanted it bad enough, they would make an exception, they would make up special rules for him. Whatever the case is, this should have gotten hashed out before he got on a plane. And it's just such a distraction. Like, every time this stuff happens, I don't understand how tennis keeps getting just overwhelmed by news stories that are off the court BS. And I mean, some of the BS is, you know, valid geopolitical concerns. Like, I'm not calling like the Peng Shuai case BS, but it's off the court stuff, and it absolutely consumes tennis media for sometimes weeks on end. And I'm glad we're talking about that case. I'm glad of some other off court stuff we've talked about over the years, but it drives me nuts how the tennis media will drop everything, including their coverage of tennis, to cover these stories that really don't matter. I mean, what I try to think about when this stuff comes up is, how will we talk about this in 3 years or 5 years or 10 years? And even with Novak at 20 slams, with this being potentially a difference maker in the all-time GOAT debate, like, in 5 years, will this be a bigger deal than the default to Carreño Busta? I mean, I don't think so. I think, especially if he doesn't play, it'll be this gap in his record. People will know why it's there. But did he miss slam number 21 because of this? Not as much as he missed it because of that default. Not as much as he missed it because, you know, he got to some other finals and lost. So I think in 5 years, this is a stupid historical footnote, and we'll all wonder why we were consumed by it for a week when there were dozens, if not hundreds, of interesting tennis matches going on. Probably hundreds since the qualifying week. But
so two things off of that. Sorry, I don't mean to cut you off. A,
no, please.
Conspiracy Jeff, strong in this podcast. He's burying the Carreño Busta story by not getting vaccinated. I think Novak Djokovic has done crazier things. Like, I'm going to throw that as a 10% chance of likelihood. I would give that, you know, again, that's the ELO for that.
Crazier things than what?
Not getting vaccinated to bury him hitting Carreño Busta in the throat. Like, he just doesn't want anyone talking about that story anymore. We're not, Jeff. I think that's the conspiracy theory here.
I don't think that's going to work. I think people will be talking. No, I'm serious. People will be talking about that for as long as they're arguing about the greatest of all time.
If
Novak goes on to win 25 slams, then maybe not. But if he ends up within one or two of someone else, like, that's going to be a story in every instance of this debate for a generation or two. And if he doesn't play the Australian Open, then it's forgotten about. I mean, Nadal has missed slams. I mean, remember when people were speculating that Nadal was missing parts of seasons because of a silent ban?
Yeah.
Like, we don't really talk about that anymore. I mean, probably rightfully so. It probably was just a stupid conspiracy theory, but I mean, that was sort of a big story, not in the press the way that the Novak story is right now, but we've pretty much forgotten about that. I mean, I know this from looking back at history. Generally, it isn't a story when people don't show up for slams. Like, maybe it should be, but we talk about the matches that get played and the results of those matches. We don't talk about the matches that didn't happen.
Yeah, very, very true. And again, this is a random note. I have been fortunate enough to, and this is how you know they're going deep in the Rolodex on this Djokovic story, and then everyone else has taken, is I've gotten asked to do some TV appearances, and it was I don't know if this is funny, but to me it was hilarious. The lead-in segments to me, Jeff, were Ian Bremmer on the decline of American democracy, a reporter on the ground in Kazakhstan. And now let's go to Alex Gruskin on Novak Djokovic. Alex, you know, he goes, Novak's mom said this is his greatest victory, greater than any victory on the court. Do you agree? And I was like, wait, can we go back to the democracy thing? I've got some follow-ups. And, you know, thankfully I didn't say that because it was time number one. But that's all I could think is, like, am I not going to get a question on the decline? I've got 3 minutes on Kevin McCarthy in me. Everything you said resonates with me, Jeff. And one reason I also want to ask you on it, about this is you made a very, I think, pertinent point of how is this not all figured out before you get on the plane? I won't lie. I have not done much international travel in my life. And the times I have traveled internationally, I was not the person taking care of all of the visa and immigration stuff. It was either my father or when I was traveling with my school. That is the sort of thing you clear up before you get there, right? Like this sort of visa miscommunication, and a lot of it comes back to, and I've made this point, many have made this point, how Craig Tiley will have a job after all of this will be quite the question. But how is that not figured out before you get on the plane?
Yeah, I mean, and I don't know whether that means that people didn't do their job beforehand or it's just Australian politicians who saw the opportunity to just pose a distraction. I mean, that sure. And you know, if you want to tie it back into the decline of American democracy, wow, we're really staying on track here. At least it's America. This is, I was gonna say, this is straight out of Trump's playbook, but it's not just Trump's playbook. It's the idea that politicians want to distract from their failures, whether they're to blame for the failures or not, whether it's a high unemployment rate or COVID restrictions or whatever it is that's controversial. The best way to hide it is to create some other controversy. And if Scott Morrison or whoever else has things at stake in Australia sees the opportunity to bury something unpopular with something they can, you know, get a slam dunk on, then it's a really hard thing for a politician to resist. It just sucks for everybody. A, it sucks for the people who get slam dunked on, and B, it sucks for those of us who get to live through that news cycle, especially if we remember what it is that they're trying to bury.
Yeah, it's again very much resonates with me, everything you are saying, Jeff. And so the saga continues to unfold. We still don't know. Just to put the end piece on it, how's the top five ELO change if he is not in the draw? I imagine, by the way, Sinner's got to be near that top five by the percentages. And that's not this podcast. He's in my top five. I think by the odds, he's like number six right now. But what do the ELO look like with and without Djokovic?
Let me see if I ran it after this week. I know before I updated with week one results, with Djokovic, Medvedev and Djokovic are basically tied in the hardcourt ELO ratings. And Medvedev has a very minor edge. So I think the results were like 30% Medvedev for the title, 26% or 27% Djokovic for the title, and then Zverev around, I want to say 20 or 22. Sure. And then if Djokovic doesn't play, it becomes 40% Medvedev, 30% Zverev. And then, yeah, Alcaraz and Sinner are, I want to say, fifth and sixth. That starts to depend a lot on how the draw shakes out. But without knowing the draw, yeah, they're in there. And Alcaraz might be a little bit high right now because ELO doesn't do a great job if someone ends with a winning streak like Alcaraz did at the Next Gen Finals. So he might be a little high, but I don't think Sinner is. There's no good reason to look at Sinner's ELO rating and say, oh, he didn't quite deserve that, because he did, flat out. I don't have the numbers with Djokovic, but through week one, Medvedev is 39%, Zverev is 29%, followed by Sinner, then Tsitsipas, then Alcaraz, then Ruud. Those are your six favorites if Djokovic doesn't play. And then if Djokovic does play, knock everybody down one step except for Medvedev.
Sure. And that's interesting, Berrettini falling behind those other guys. That said, I mean, anecdotally, and I obviously metric-wise, it does make sense. So that's interesting to hear. But with all that said, Let's talk Americans at the 2022 Australian Open. That's a hot intro there for all of you listeners. That's why it's always great to get Jeff back on the show. I asked you to come up with your five most interesting Americans entering the 2022 Australian Open. I gave you no other parameters. Men's players, women's players, could be whatever the sort of player you are interested in entering this event. With that in mind, let's get into the list. Number one player Jeff Sackmann is most interested in from an American perspective entering the year's first Grand Slam.
Men or women?
Either way, whichever you're most... Just give me number one on the list.
Korda.
Oh, you know what's fascinating is you are not the first person to say that. And he was not on my list. So explain to me.
Well, I mean, you did have Nelly Korda on your show. You could have seen that coming. You know, he's... Well... I don't know whether this is the slam, but first of all, he's had an interesting career for such a young player. He had one of his first breakthroughs. Didn't he make the fourth round at the French? Mm-hmm. Basically coming out of nowhere. Like, people knew he was a prospect, but absolutely nobody thought that was the moment he was going to make a breakthrough. So the fact that he didn't have a huge end of the season, the people who were getting excited about Korda, like I feel like some of them kind of forgot about him in the last 6 months, but I can completely see him, you know, just smashing his way back into the American consciousness here. Like he's going to do that sometime. I don't think it's going to be a gradual, like, quarterfinals at 250s and semifinals at 500s. It's not going to work like that for him. He's going to make a semifinal at a slam or win Indian Wells or something. And then he's going to be 22 and people are going to realize this is the guy. So I don't know whether this is when it's going to happen, but I mean, if you're looking for players to be interested in, there's a lot of Americans, especially on the women's side, you can expect good things from, but I'm not sure that looking at the top women, I see anybody who I think is ready to make a major breakthrough. But Korda is absolutely. So, I mean, he would be my top pick to go the furthest among the American men, although I have to point out, being the, you know, provider of the ELOs, that he's a little bit behind Taylor Fritz mm-hmm. in the hardcore ELO rating. So if I go strictly with the numbers, then he's fractionally less likely to make it to, say, the fourth round of the quarterfinals than mm-hmm. Taylor Fritz is.
Yeah, you know, again, would we be doing 20 minutes on Jensen Brooksby right now if he was in the tournament? Probably.
And then another 20.
Yeah, exactly. I'd keep you here till 9 p.m., but, you know, with Sebastian Korda, it is fascinating because you look at the numbers for him last season, you know, 24.6 break percentage is the highlight number. That was, I believe, top 20 amongst top 50 players. I think even top 15 amongst top 50 players. 31 wins on the ATP Tour, 31-18 overall. Anytime you're winning over 60% of your matches, you're moving up the rankings. He was able to do so throughout the course of the season, reaches a career high number 38 at the end of October, enters the year at number 40. Of course, he made the Delray final last season, but then he didn't play the Australian Open. So these are low-hanging fruit for him to pick in terms of building his ranking. This Australian Open, getting one win even, will help him out. But if you can get two, three wins, now you're talking about a top 30, top 25 push from him. The interesting number, and again, low-hanging fruit being the operative term here, is the hold percentage. He was at 80.9 last season. It's a little better than the average of top 50 players, 80.6%, although it's notable that he ranked 29th amongst top 50 players in hold percentage, despite having a slightly above average number there. Of course, you look at him from a size perspective, a foundational perspective, there's no reason he can't be top 20, top 15 from a hold percentage perspective. The plus one shots are there on both the forehand, backhand wing. I think he's both a willing and comfortable volleyer. The second serve hangs up. Like, that's the big thing for him. And he wins only 50.5% of his second serve points last season. It reminds me of young Tsitsipas from a movement perspective. Tsitsipas was a little stiff when he was 19, 20, 21 years old. I think Korda is as well, but I don't think foundationally he's a bad athlete. I just think he's a young athlete. That said, like, to me, the barometer of success for Sebastian Korda, particularly given many of the health struggles he's dealt with early in his career, is just like, give me another 52 weeks. Give me another 60 matches or 50 matches where you're winning over 60% of them. You're sustaining your top 50 ranking. Yeah, I'd like a top 30 push. I don't need top 20, top 10 from him this season. I need health, and then I just need to see the typical growth on serve that I think you'd like to see from any young player. I don't know, maybe that's why I'm not irrationally excited for him. I don't see the big leap coming from him this season, but I guess perhaps I'm wrong.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, you've taken a stance against mine, so probably. you could be right. I don't disagree with anything you're saying, and clearly his game has a ways to go. We've just seen him, even this early in his career, we've seen him go on streaks, whether it's his French Open debut or winning Delray, quarterfinals in Miami last year, winning Parma on clay. I mean, not really high level competition there, but I mean, this dude won a clay court tournament that he probably didn't care that much about. That's a big breakthrough right there. It just seems like I agree. It would be a solid step forward for him to give us a good 52 weeks on tour and even just solidify the ranking, let alone move it up. But I don't think that's the kind of player he's going to be. I think we're going to see some ups and downs, and the downs might keep him from being a number one someday, but the ups are going to mean, I mean, I hate looking at a player his age and saying, I think he's going to win a slam, but I can't help looking at this player and thinking he's going to win a slam. So like I say, I don't think that slam is going to be right now, but I wouldn't be surprised if we get a couple really big runs from him this year. And I mean, chaos abounds down under right now. So why not?
No, it's fascinating because the rise of American men's tennis was one of the storylines to end last season, and it wasn't Korda. It was Fritz at Indian Wells, Opelka in Canada, Tommy Paul winning his first title at the end of last season, Nakashima back-to-back finals in Los Cabos in Atlanta, of course, Brooksby making the semifinals in D.C., winning the 6-1 first set like he meant it against Novak Djokovic at the U.S. Open. Obviously, you have a Cressy final here to start 2022 as well, and boy, would I love to hear your thoughts on Cressy. Maybe we'll get to him in your list. But, like, we weren't talking about Korda. And it's interesting you talk about the growth in his game. Again, I'm going to disagree with you. If Sebastian Korda does not get a lick better at tennis, I still think he can be a top 10 player. I think for him, the answer is the physicality. I don't think that he has that element to him yet that's required to be a top 10 guy in men's tennis. And by the way, he's not even 22 years old yet, doesn't turn 22 till July. That physicality will come. To me, that's why that's the biggest question, is that's the missing piece. He already hits his backhand, I would say top 5 amongst ATP Tour backhands, but you know, again, yes, the forehand, he'll get better as a volley, or the second serve will get better, but I just think those are things every player will improve throughout the course of their career. I don't really have questions about Korda's game. It's just, for me, a physicality question, and so you're right. That's why he's so interesting, because I think he's got the game to have success already.
Well, when you think about the guys with potential physical limitations, then those are often the players who have pretty severe ups and downs, and those are maybe the types of players we should be particularly attentive to during slams, is that's when you get a day off between matches. And yes, sure, best of five is a whole different set of challenges, so that could weigh more heavily than having the days off. But I mean, it goes both ways. If he gets hot early in the tournament and, you know, wins some matches in straight sets, then that's not really much worse than playing best of three. So it's easier to make a run to, say, the quarterfinals at a slam than it is to, I don't know, let's say win Shanghai. I don't know if there'll be a Shanghai in 2022, but winning six matches in a row on six consecutive days, like, I think that might be more demanding for somebody like him than reaching the quarterfinals in Australia, unless, you know, somebody pushes him to five sets on Wednesday of week one. I mean, you never know about that kind of thing, but what makes the physicality so important these days is just how tough the week in, week out grind is. Mm-hmm. So that's where you'll see players make a run and then, you know, withdraw from a tournament and then retire in the second round and then struggle for a couple weeks and then make another run. And it is true, it's hard for those guys to make the top 10. And I mean, some players never really bounce back from that. So maybe he'll develop that down the road, maybe he won't. But I mean, I feel like you don't need to have that to be worth watching, right? I mean, that's basically what happened with Bernard Tomic. He's He gave us those big runs early in his career. He didn't really back it up on tour. He was better on tour then than he is now, obviously. But for him, it was a totally different set of issues than I think Korda has. But I think it's the same general idea. The talent was there. You could turn it on for a couple of weeks and turn in a big result. And yeah, I mean, I let's bet on Korda like we might retrospectively bet on a 21-year-old Bernard Tomic and then hope for something better from Korda down the line.
Yeah, no, I mean, Tomic was the original Medvedev. God, talk about a guy who could do so many different things on the court. His feel, and then he was 6'5", 6'6", could crank serves. You just, yeah, you wish he was locked in when he was 18, 19, 21 years old. But that's a story for a different time. I'm going to get to the number one player on my list now, and I think you knew this was coming when I tweeted out a month ago, however long it was, that I think...
Let me guess, are there five letters in her name?
Yes, I think you did a better job. Well, I don't know, I think we did an equal job, me giving your take on Novak Djokovic, you being able to guess my first player. It is Ann Lee, of course, who was very, very strong. 10 the 2021 season, makes, you know, or wins the title in Tenerife quarterfinals, Courmayeur, and, you know, semifinals to start off her season in Melbourne. Now, you know, didn't rack up the most impressive wins throughout that run, but, you know, certainly racked up wins at the WTA Tour level, has worked her way all the way up to number 42, I believe, in the WTA ELO rankings, number 44, a career high for her in the WTA rankings right now. When I watch Ann Lee play, it's just a ball of explosion. Like, just every ball explodes off of her racket, and her ability to use her quickness to get to the ball, take it early on the rise, beat you to the spot. There's a slingshot element to the game as well. Again, it's just everything on the court comes very easy to Ann Lee. And when you look at the numbers for her last season, yeah, the hold percentage, 69.3%, that lags a bit behind other top 50 players. But the 39.1 break percentage, that's a top 10 number right away on the women's amongst top 50 players on the women's tour. And I understand, given her size, maybe with the bigger serves, it becomes a little bit more difficult for her. But Ann Lee's game passes the eye test with flying colors. Everything comes so smoothly. She's a comfortable and willing volleyer, but that's not when she's at her best, of course. It's when she's at the baseline. We just didn't get to see her healthy at many of the slams last season. And you look overall, Australia, when she was healthy, third-round loss to the GOAT, Aryna Sabalenka, you know, wins her first-round match at Roland Garros before getting knocked out by Svitolina. First-round loss at Wimbledon to Podoroska, but wasn't able to play that, you know, that many events between, I believe it was, I want to say, March and May, or the end of May due to an injury. You know, disappointing that U.S. Open loss for her, certainly first-round to Kutsova. But I'm telling you, Jeff, Ann Lee might end this year as the number one-ranked American. I just think her game is ready to explode.
I know we did this on Twitter, and I want to devise like a very simple like a ranking predictor where you take sure. like every 21 year old, or is she 21?
She's 21. 20. Yeah.
If you take every 21 year old within a certain ranking range, see where they end up the next year, and then run a simulation for everyone in the top 100, see what their range of possible outcomes is a year later. And once you do enough of those, you'll end up with basically not just a predicted ranking, but a sense of like, what's the likelihood that, like you say, Ann Lee becomes the number one American, or what's the likelihood that Ann Lee is top 30 or something. And I think I said on Twitter that it might be 1%. And I think even that's high, and that's not a knock on Ann Lee. It's just an enormous thing you're suggesting. I mean, so many things have to go right. And to me, the headline fact about Ann Lee is that she just hasn't played top competition yet. She's got five matches in her career against players ranked better than number 20. She's lost all five. She's won one set in those five matches. That was its tiebreak against Kvitova. And I would guess that if she did play 20 or 30 matches against top 10 players, she wouldn't lose them all. She has the game to hang with those players. But I think you're dream casting based on someone who looks very good at challengers and 250s. and it's a really tempting thing to do. And maybe she's 3 years away or 5 years away from being the number one American. I feel like all of your takes on Ann Lee are like, they're all 50% too far for me. I want to say, yeah, she's great. I love the way she plays. I want to see more. I want to see how much she can improve. And to me, that means like best case, maybe she's the number four American at the end of the year. That would be a nice big step. Maybe she's top 30. That might be even a little bit too much, but I'd be willing to go with that. So I'll definitely be watching. I just think it feels like we should be having this conversation in another year or two, but I know we've got to be the tennis hipsters here and have this conversation now, preferably 3 years ago, but it feels like a better conversation for 2024.
Always better to be a year early than a year late. I was talking about this with Chris Halioris, who we do all of our college tennis pods with, and is, like you, is very good at running the numbers, aka excellent at Excel. It's a skill I lack. I really should have paid more attention in those classes. But I would love to see what, from an efficiency number standpoint, is the most optimal schedule for Ann Lee to take another rankings jump this year. And if you're extraordinarily bored come late February, early March, which I know you never are, Jeff, and you want to run the numbers, what does the ideal, you know, what is the most efficient schedule for rising the rankings? I'm curious what that would look like. And I'm curious how many players actually use those sorts of metrics in crafting their schedules.
Well, I've looked at that a little bit, and it's a really, really hard question over the course of a full season, I mean, for a million reasons. And since we only have a limited amount of time left, I'm not going to spell them all out.
Yeah, but you can't control how much other people are playing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And you don't know how much your own ranking is going to move. So if you're planning things out in January and thinking about where you'll play in September, where you play in September might depend on how you play between now and then in terms of what tournaments you can get into. But the basic idea, which I worked out a long time ago, and this is particularly relevant when you have two tournaments to choose from in the same week, but I think you can use some of the same principles for a whole season if you're deciding which weeks to go to rest or which weeks to play, is if you will be seeded, it's better to enter that tournament than a stronger tournament where you're not seeded. So if you be number eight at a 250, that's better than being unseeded at a 500. Otherwise, you want to enter the strongest possible tournament you can, because there's so many more points available. If you're going to be seeded in both, you have similar advantages. If you're unseeded in both, you've got similar challenges in both. The numbers aren't absolutely clear cut on that, and you have to take in surface into consideration as well, because I mean, maybe for Ann Lee, it's better to have a weaker hard court tournament than a clay court tournament with more points available. I don't know. But generally, pick the stronger tournament, the strongest tournament you can, unless you can drop down one rung and get a seed. That's the principle.
I like it. Well, with that in mind, give me your next, we'll flip gears here. Give me your number one woman on your list.
Well, are we asking for most interesting? Or are we asking for the one I think is going to make it the furthest?
We'll get to that. I want to get to the furthest at the end. So let's do two more interesting if we can.
Okay. Most interesting, hands down, is Anna Samova. I've been a huge fan. I mean, maybe huge fans overstating it. I have seen the potential for a long time. I know a guy who was her hitting partner for a while when she was coming up. So I heard a little bit about her before she was getting the results, and I knew she was on the way. And her early results on tour were, I mean, she looked so good, and she was so successful at an early age. You never know what's going to happen when a teenager gets sidelined with injuries like she's had to deal with. I mean, there's so many women in WTA history who never really bounced back. So if you'd asked me the same question 2 weeks ago, I probably wouldn't have even put her in the top 10 of this list, because you can't count on that sort of bounce back. But now that she did bounce back and win in tournaments, like, boom, she's in the conversation again. Like, if you want to pick a long shot for number one American woman at the end of the year, I'll take Anna Samova over Ann Lee every day of the week. So do I expect her to be around in the second week in Melbourne? Probably not. The odds are against that. She's probably going to, you know, play Svitolina in round two and lose. But mean, it, the possibility is there. And if it's not this year, it's a year or two from now. If she stays healthy, the forehand is so big. The talent is just enormous. I'm super excited to see her being successful again.
First title since 2019, first semifinal for her last week since the start of 2020. I mean, after she made that Roland Garros semifinal, and she's someone who had a bunch of junior slam success early in her career as well, she had weekend privileges at Serena Williams Power Tennis Country Club. She's always been allowed to hang out whenever she'd like. And I mean, you look at what she was able to accomplish, really what she's been able to accomplish since the start of the hard court season last year, 14-6 overall in those 20 matches. When you're winning 70% of your matches, you're moving back up the rankings. She's back up to number 61, was hitting the first serve extraordinarily well. I mean, go watch the Pliskova highlights from the U.S. Open. What was that? Third round, I want to say. Second round, whatever that match was. She lost 7-6 in the third. You could tell then that Anisimova had regained her footing. And, you know, much like we talked about with Korda, I think it's a physical thing for Anisimova. She's not the best mover, but the weapons and the actual playing of tennis has never been an issue for her. I mean, after her title run to start the season, how can she not be on this list? What sort of seeded player or any player in the draw would want to match up against her weapons, right? Because when she plays her best, it's just the ball is on her racket. She is in control of the match. So I agree. Like, she's, I mean, I'm curious, after last week, what is she up to in the Elo? She's had to have making a solid jump from where she was prior to everything. I believe up to number 30 right now in the Elo ratings. That speaks to how highly, you know, the numbers think of her past results. It speaks to how these results impact their thinking of her now, right? Like, that she's much closer to the 30 ELO when she plays her best than the current ranking she has.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, just, I have to point
this out since you teed it up for me. That is universally true. Virtually every player on the list is closer to their ELO rating than they are to their official ranking, because the official ranking is, like, by definition, it's 6 months out of date. So yeah. Sometimes Elo gets a little overexcited, but in this case, I don't, even though those cases tend to be players who, you know, take a big jump and win a title without a lot of activity in their recent history, I don't think this is one of those cases. I think 30, or I think she's 27 in the hardcore Elo. I think that's exactly where she belongs. She's at least that dangerous.
All right. With that said, again, rapid fire here, because I know you have to go. Tommy Paul, Riley Opelka, Taylor Fritz, Francis Tiafo, four guys, and Stefan Kozlov's honestly in this draw as well. Five guys who have been of the same American generation of juniors forever. You know, Kozlov makes a couple of junior slams. Australia, Wimbledon, Noah Rubin wins one the next year. Paul, Opelka, Fritz all win junior slams. I think Tiafo was still the highest ranked junior at the time starting that season, and wins Kalamazoo over Kozlov, wins Orange Bowl. You know, that group has had so much success together. They all seem to be ascending towards the top 30, towards the top 20 together as well. Of that group, who's your most interesting?
I think it's Tiafo. And again, it comes down to most interesting, or what we predict for this month. Like, I had Taylor Fritz as my number two guy at the Australian Open behind Korda. And then Tiafo actually behind Nakashima. But if we're talking about most interesting, I'm always looking for variability. None of these guys are like lock top five players, some more than others. But there are no lock top five players among the Americans right now. That's just a fact, except for maybe Coco Gauff. And if you're not a lock top five player, then what makes you interesting is the potential to sneak in and make a slam final, or I mean, sneak in and win Indian Wells, something like that. And whether or not, say, let's just say Tiafo versus Tommy Paul, they're basically tied in the hardcore ELO rankings right now. So they're next to each other on my list. Both really solid players, both have some room to improve, both seem to work pretty hard and could very well make that improvement. Wouldn't be surprised if either one of them ends up creeping into the top 20 at the end of this year. But personally, I don't care that much about that. That it wasn't what makes them interesting. If I'm picking one of those two guys to do something that we'll be talking about at the end of the year, it's Tiafo. I mean, I wouldn't be shocked if Tommy Paul ended up making a run and, you know, made the final in Miami or something. But if I'm picking one of those two guys to do it, it's definitely Tiafo, and maybe even Tiafo over Fritz, although that's a close one.
All good picks. I think Tommy's playing the best. Well, I think Fritz is playing the best of the bunch right now. And I think I will be shocked if we end 2022 and Taylor Fritz has still not made a fourth round at a Grand Slam. Tommy and Tiafoe are both playing better than this guy right now. But the most interesting to me of the group is Riley Opelka. Because you look at Riley's season last year, 21-22 overall. Outside of his run in Canada, his round of 16 at the U.S. Open, and his semifinal in Rome, he lost a lot of, you know, first or second round matches last year. And you look for him. And by the way, one of my favorite features on the Tennis Abstract scrolling features that you can do first match, second match, and just see their records there. Riley was 11-10 in first matches last season, 4-7 in second matches and events. And again, his four wins, Rome, Roland Garros, Canada, U.S. Open. Obviously, those are four very good places for him to have those sorts of runs. That's why he cracked the top 20 and is currently number 25 in the rankings. But I need more first-round consistency. I need better from Riley Opelka. His, you know, you look at the numbers for him last season, he holds, I think it was 88.5% of the time. A, he should be over the 90% threshold where the Berrettinis, Isners, Raonic's of the world live if he's going to hit his ceiling as a player. But B, we talk about all the time, well, his ground strokes look better than John Isner's. He's a better mover than Isner. 9.9 break percentage is unacceptable. If you're under 20%, you are a bad returner on the ATP Tour. If you're under 10%, you're laughably bad. And his foundation is too good to be laughably bad anymore. And it's just, if he's going to take a step forward again, if he can get to 15% break percentage, it, you know, he gets to 20% break percentage, he's a top 10 guy. If he can even get to 15, though, it's just those second round losses become victories. And it's just, it's time for him to be more consistent.
Yeah, your point about first-round results is exactly the limitation of players who have the really weak return games. Mm-hmm. And pretty much by definition, those are going to be the monster servers. Is if you're counting on winning tiebreaks, you can't count. I mean, I phrased that the wrong way to start the sentence. You can't count on winning tiebreaks. If you're Riley Opelka, you can count on getting to tiebreaks, but you just can't count on winning them. And that's what makes me a little worried about Cressy. I want to get excited about Cressy. I am a little bit excited about Cressy, but he's never going to break serve a lot, I don't think. And I mean, hopefully he'll be better than an Opelka or Isner's break rate. But if he is going to win a whole bunch of 7-6, 6-7, 7-6 matches or 7-6, 7-6 matches, then he's going to end up stuck in the same kind of limbo that you're describing with Opelka, where he's going to have a good run now and then. We're going to get excited, especially since he has a unique game style. But it's going to be hard for him to have that kind of consistency. And it's going to be hard for him to crack the top 20. I mean, for him, getting close to that top 20 would be a win at this point, but I know he wants to go a lot higher. And yeah, it's really hard. I mean, you're right that Opelka has the tools. We've seen him with the tools to be a better returner for a long time, but there just isn't a long history of players who arrive on tour as bad returners and develop into only moderately bad returners. If you're bad, you generally stay bad. And I mean, bad is the wrong word here, because I mean, they're great returners. They're just playing against players who are even greater than they are. But it's a huge, huge obstacle to overcome. It's a lot more common, still rare, but a lot more common for players to arrive on tour without a big serve and develop a better serve. But there's not much benefit in Cressy or Opelka or guys like that doing that, because there's not a whole lot of room for them to go up from there. So it's tough for me to get excited about players whose game is structured like that.
I agree with you. I will say this, though. A bad returner can still break more than 10% of the time. And to be
you
under
sure
10%,
so.
Yeah, that's just, that's not going to cut it. Mathematically,
I mean,
I
had a dream that I spent a year on tour, and I think I broke 12.4% of the time.
That wasn't a dream. That was a simulation. You just didn't realize it because it was your, you know, 10,000th of the day. All right. I'm inherently intrigued in Nakashima. I think Cressy should be fined $5 every time he hits a backhand slice in a baseline rally, because his backhand was good. Like, I really enjoyed watching it against Rafa, to your point about Cressy. And again, I think all of these players are fascinating. I should have said, and I meant to, I hope Ann Lee has a Coco Gauff 2021-like season. If she can work in one Slam quarterfinal, a WTA title, the consistency Gauff showed throughout those first 6 months of last year, if she can do that, that's a win for me. I meant to say that earlier. But you talk about the Goffs of the world, or again, Pegula has not had a good start to her single season. She was so great on the hard court events last year. Shelby Rogers is striking the ball so cleanly right now. Madison Keys lights out against Elena Svitolina. She belongs on this list as well. Plenty of fascinating Americans. I know you have to go, so my last question to you. Give me the lamps. Give me the law. I don't even know what it would be. Lops? Lops? The lops? Yeah, the lamps and the lops. Who are the last American male and women's players standing?
I was really hoping you were going to define your terms because I didn't
yeah. know. Yeah, last American male player and last American female player.
Okay. I'm going Korda with the men. I mean, like I said before, more variability with Korda. If I have to go with like the most likely to make the third round or something, then it's Taylor Fritz, but I'll still go with Korda. And then with the women, I have a hard time with this because it's not my favorite player, not by a long shot among this group, but by far the ELO favors Danielle Collins. So I have to go with Danielle Collins here. And one last thought to tack on, since it's not going to be a good answer to any of your questions, so we'll pretend like you asked it instead. The shocking thing to me in looking over the numbers before we had this conversation was the number of American men in the draw who are, you know, interesting enough to watch. Maybe the number of American draw on the Americans in the draw period. The number of men is about the same as the number of women. And the degree to which they are threatening for deep runs is about the same. And of course, that's because Serena isn't here. If she were here, we'd be having a different conversation. But it's been a long time since we've been in that position. I mean, since the days of Tim Smicek that we could really get excited about an American man like that. I think I have 10 American men playing this tournament, so not counting Brooksby, who are ranked 63 or higher in hardcore ELO. So that's the top half of the Australian Open draw. These are guys who, depending on the draw, are probably favored to at least win a round. Among the women, there are only 9 playing, and then Sloan at 74. So Sloan is basically in the conversation. So we've got about 10 American women as well. I mean, it's obviously great to still have some strong and interesting American women in the field, and I'm not suggesting we don't, because we do, but the men are there too, which is fun time to be an American fan for those of you who are.
Absolutely. That said, bonus question, what are we going to do about Sabalenka? Oof. I know. I couldn't let you go without, what, we had gone 53 minutes. That's a record for us without bringing her up.
I mean, even when we're not on Zoom together, we rarely go 53 minutes without talking about Sabalenka. I don't know.
I don't know either. I saw there's an underhand serve she hit and she won the point. And I was like, maybe this will work. I was like, oh my God. And like, even in these losses, she's still almost, I don't know what to do, Jeff.
Yeah, it's wild, and it's not even, I mean, it's getting to be yips at this point, but it's not pressure yips. It's just forgetting how to serve yips. It's so weird. So, I mean, I said on Twitter that, you know, that we might have thought that, you know, Djokovic causing a geopolitical storm was a wild thing to have, or unexpected thing to have happened in 2022, but it is nothing compared to Aryna Sabalenka serving underhanded. No one saw that coming. I don't know. I mean, normally I would say I would just expect it to shake itself out. Maybe I had a crazy thought that's probably wrong, that, you know, Guadalajara really threw her off, since she was not serving well in Guadalajara at all. But I hope that, you know, with 2 months of off season between the two tournaments, I hope that isn't still affecting her. But I don't know. Maybe go back to Dmitry Tursunov and I guess you'd have to fight him away from Anett Kontaveit, which is not going to happen right now. But go back to Tursunov or a coach who can make her laugh enough that she'll stop thinking about her serve. It's so weird. Of all the players you'd expect to lose their serve like she has, I'm not sure she would be in the top 50 of my list. It's just bizarre.
Well, I will say this. If the prerequisite for coaching Aryna Sabalenka is make her laugh enough, I've never before felt as qualified as I do right now. That is a job I would thrive at, Jeff. And so just throwing it out there for the Sabalenka camp. If that's what you're looking for, a distraction, I can provide it. But with all that said, again, all the work at tennisabstract.com, essential to doing what I do, what all of us in tennis media try to do, cover the sport. It helps fans better educate themselves about the game. Of course, we're immensely grateful for that, Jeff. Immensely grateful for you exposing my drinking habits. I've subsequently shifted down. The truth is, I don't drink. It's just like I'm goofy enough. And there's a thing, Ashkenazi Jews, not particularly receptive to alcohol, something in the genes. I read a paper once. Not that that's true, but that's now my cop-out.
Are you an Ashkenazi Jew?
I am an Ashkenazi Jew.
Okay, I thought that would be a really wild cop-out if you weren't actually.
Which, again, would make Aryna Sabalenka laugh if that was my excuse. I'm just saying. And that was the case. But all of that said, Jeff, immensely grateful for all you do. Anything to plug?
No, I mean, like I say, I've got a big project coming soon. I think I'm going to announce it the week after the Australian Open. So keep your eyes peeled on Tennis Abstract in early February. It's going to be pretty intense. But until then, you know, there's lots of numbers still on the site. You can sort them. And then if you get crazy, you can put them in Excel and multiply and divide them. It's really up to you at that point. But tennisabstract.com is the place to be.
I tried the multiplying. I got caught up on the dividing. That's the next step for me.
That's where it gets tricky.
Yeah. I've R2 over R3 in the formula. The dash never works for me. And so, you know, I always screw up on the cells.
Well, do you have Clippy?
I think I do have Clippy, who's talked me through. Look, we've had some therapy sessions, me and Clippy, let me tell you. But sometimes I'll ask him questions like, why is Arena serve like it is? And he'll be like, I got nothing for you, Alex.
And he says, you know, you need to add a parenthesis at the end of the formula. Maybe that's what you need to tell her. Arena, you need a closed parenthesis.
Yeah. Why didn't you say so? It's so clear now. But Jeff, as always, thank you for taking the time. Be safe. Be healthy. We'll chat more soon.
Absolutely. Talk to you soon, Alex.
Hope all of you enjoyed today's conversation with Tennis Abstract's Jeff Sackman. I said it at the top. I say it on every mini break podcast I do sincerely, though. If you're not using Tennis Abstract, you're just not enjoying tennis fandom the way you should be. And again, you're not going to find more detail, more information available to you than the database Jeff has put together there. So a huge thank you, Tim, as always, for taking the time to come on this show, but of course a huge thank you to him for his contributions to the tennis community. Again, this is one of multiple Australian Open preview podcasts we have coming down the queue, and of course we've returned to our bench of Cracked Rackets returning champions to help me preview all of the action. We'll talk draw previews when they come out, men's and women's contenders, men's and women's dark horses over the next few days. All of those episodes available wherever you listen to your podcast or on our website, crackedrackets.com. Of course, like, rate, subscribe for you to this show, the Mini Break, Cracked Interviews podcast, and our YouTube channel to make sure you don't miss out on any of our content. Of course, if you need the more immediate updates, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, we are at Cracked Rackets. You want to message me directly, I am at Great Shot Pod. A shout out as always to our super producer Daniel Westhoff for the of an editing job he does day in, day out. With all of that said, for our fantastic guest Jeff Sackman, our super producer Daniel Westhoff, and all of us here at both Cracked Rackets and the Tennis Channel Podcast Network, I'm your host Alex Gruskin. You know what we say, hey, great shot, and we'll talk to you all next time. Thanks everyone.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.